Happy Friday, everybody. Welcome to the Michael Cutler Hour. I am your host, Michael Cutler. Hope you've all had a good week. I know that parts of this country have been getting some more wacky weather. It's just been that kind of summer, whether the weather we're talking about is meteorological or the lunacy emanating out of our nation's capital. One way or the other, we seem to be destined to get hammered, at least for the foreseeable future. That's a heck of a forecast, isn't it? My name is Mike Cutler, as I pointed out. I'm a retired senior special agent with what used to be the Immigration and Naturalization Service. Those of you who are familiar with me know about my background, know that ever since 9/11, as a New Yorker, as an American, I decided that with my perspectives, my experiences, that I needed to provide what I know about immigration and national security to my fellow Americans and to our nation's leaders. Immigration is a very important issue, not a single issue, but a singular issue, because it impacts just about every challenge and threat that both America and Americans are facing today. The immigration laws were enacted for just two purposes: to protect innocent lives and the jobs of American workers. You would think that something that's that straightforward and that common sense shouldn't even require a debate. But again, we live in a wacky world with all kinds of strange things happening. I'm convinced we have fallen into an alternative universe, perhaps. If you want to read more about me, find out more about what makes Mike Cutler tick, so to speak, two great websites for you to visit. First of all, my own personal website, michaelcutler.net, M-I-C-H-A-E-L-C-U-T-L-E-R, one word, michaelcutler.net. I also write for a terrific website, a terrific organization, Californians for Population Stabilization. Their awesome website is capsweb.org, C-A-P-S, capsweb.org, located in beautiful downtown Santa Barbara. We are kind of the bookends of America. They're on the West Coast, I'm on the East Coast, but between the miracle of computers, jet planes, and telephones, I've been working very closely with them for a number of years. Most recently, they were able to help make it possible for me, in fact, to travel from Arizona, where I was delivering a speech with Congressman Gosar, former Congressman Tom Tancredo, Zach Taylor, former Border Patrol supervisor, and head to Washington, D.C., July 15th. With the Black American Leadership Alliance to participate in a rally in opposition to comprehensive immigration reform. So that's what I've been up to. I have an amazing guest joining me this evening, Jeff Currier, and I know I'm probably getting his name sideways, but he's an interesting character. He is the host of Ringside Politics, and he also works as an analyst and columnist on a number of television programs. So this is a guy that I think will have a very interesting perspective on where things are at this point, and I've invited him to join me. And let's see if, Jeff, is that you?
Mike, how are you?
I am terrific, buddy. Happy Friday.
Yes. Yes, it's been a long week, but I'm glad to conclude it with you. So thanks for having me.
Well, always my pleasure, and of course, the turnabout is fair play. I'll be visiting with you on your terrific program on Monday, so we will have a weekend to contemplate what we've said
right
today and what we're going to say on Monday.
Well, I'll tell you, it's timely that we're talking because the big headline today about the House Republicans having 40 to 50 votes for immigration reform in the House certainly did not make my day, I'll tell you that.
No, it certainly didn't, but it seems that Goodlatte, Bob Goodlatte, who chairs the very powerful House Judiciary Committee, just issued a press release where he says very clearly that comprehensive reform is not the way to go. So there is so much conflict in Washington, and they are conflicted over doing what's in America's best interest and the best interest of Americans, and doing what the folks with the extremely deep pockets who can't think beyond the profit motive. You know, I'm a capitalist. I believe in making a profit. But there's such a thing as blood money, don't you think?
Well, you make a great point. And I think that's what's driving a lot of the Republican support for immigration reform, big business. And as you know, the Democrats are for it because of big politics. And then the people in the middle are us who are saying, hey, secure the border. So
And it's forced immigration law. You know, too often. By the way, before we really start to get into the nitty gritty, why don't you let my listeners know a little bit about yourself, the mischief you've been making? As I remember, we first became aware of each other because of the counterterrorism blog.
Yes, I have been privileged to write for a number of years, and I get picked up by various sites around the country, and I get connected to great people like you. And you know, I'm very honored to have this radio show that's now going on its 15th year.
Wow.
And it's on WGSO Radio in New Orleans, and I'm on every weekday morning from 7 to 11. And I have a TV counterpart of that show, which is going on 14 years, which is a weekly program on, believe it or not, the local PBS affiliate. So if you can believe it, a PBS station has allowed me on there. And
By the way, you know, this is not a conservative issue. I don't know how in the world immigration is now characterized as conservative. This is an American issue. I'm a lifelong registered Democrat.
Right. And listen, I have a lot of family members that are Democrats. A lot of my best friends are.
And you don't hold it against them either, right?
No, I don't. And I'll tell you, this is something that I think should unite people. Just like here locally, we've got a coalition that I just put together of Black and white folks, Republicans and Democrats, to fight crime in the New Orleans area.
Right.
You know, fighting this as an issue should be something that unites people across, you know, both political parties. And I'm just upset, Mike, as I think you can tell, by the fact that these politicians aren't listening to the American people. And poll after poll says the American people want, you know, border security handled first. And as you know, it's just not happening. So I think we have to scream louder.
Well, you know, it's funny, though, because I always make this point because we keep hearing about the border. And you know, my point is that we really have 50 border states. In fact, if you stop and think about it, any state that has a seaport or an international airport has to be considered a border state. You know, I wrote a piece a couple of years back, maybe 5-6 years ago, and I talked about how Paul Revere had it easy. One if by land, two if by sea. When you realize the different ways that aliens could now enter the United States, if you wanted to have enough lanterns to be able to signal what was going on, you'd probably have to buy up all the lanterns at the local Lowe's or Home Depot and probably burn the Old North Church to the ground in the process. So,
you know, you make a great point. It's a very complex issue, and there are a lot of states involved. But I was telling you the other day when we were talking that one state that has a big stake in this is Texas.
Yep.
And the governor was saying there that he gets no cooperation from the federal government. They're not interested in his point of view. And Mike, that flabbergasted me. I can't believe that.
Well, but understand, we're getting the best government money can buy. You know, I'm a New Yorker, okay? And if you look at it this way, none of the terrorists who attacked America on 9/11 ran the borders. They came through ports of entry. You know, I wrote a piece a couple of weeks ago, and I'm going to quote this statement here. Now, the article I wrote, and I sent it to you, Connecting the Dots, the Nexus Between Immigration and Current Terrorist Threats. And I began my commentary, and it's a long one. It's about 11 pages. And you know what frustrates me, and I'm sure you get this also? I'll have people contact me, they'll email me or whatever, and they'll say, I'm meeting my congressman, give me three reasons why we should do this or that. And these are people who've been getting my emails, my commentaries, for the last 5 years. And I suspect that when they were back in school, they weren't even bothering with Cliff Notes. They were cheating off of their neighbor. So you got to do the heavy lifting, folks, and understand the issue so you can have an intelligent conversation with these politicians. You know, think back to the virtual fence. You know, I've probably done about 300 TV appearances. I used to be a fixture on Lou Dobbs when he was over at CNN. And when they came out with the virtual fence, the Secure Border Initiative Network, SBI Net, gosh, it sounded military. It almost sounded like they dug up General George S. Patton himself, breathed life into his corpse, stuffed him into a uniform, handed him a flag, and said, George, head for the border. I mean, think of that image. And you know, the secure border, and the nickname for it was the virtual fence. And I was on with Lou Dobbs one day, and in that Lou Dobbs voice, he said, "Mike Cutler, what do you think of the virtual fence?" And I said, "Lou, it will do what it's supposed to do, cost a ton of money and stop virtually nobody." And years later, and over $1 billion later, they found out that, in fact, the virtual fence had stopped virtually nobody. It's all about kabuki theater to create the illusions that the demands are being met when no such thing is really happening. So let me just read this paragraph. And the way I started my commentary, I said, who said this? And here's the quote. "It is perhaps obvious to state that terrorists cannot plan and carry out attacks in the United States if they're unable to enter the country. Yet prior to September 11, while there were efforts to enhance border security, no agency of the United States government thought of border security as a tool in the counterterrorism arsenal. Indeed, even after 19 hijackers demonstrated the relative ease of obtaining a U.S. visa and gaining admission into the United States, border security still is not considered a cornerstone of national security policy. We believe, for reasons we will discuss in the following pages, that it must be made one." Now, it's interesting because they make the point that I make. They're talking about border security, but they were also talking about the process by which visas are issued to foreigners and the process by which they are admitted into the United States. This goes back to my point. We have 50 border states. In fact, I testified at my very first congressional hearing on May 20th, 1997, on the issue of visa fraud and immigration benefit fraud, and the incentive for that hearing were the two terrorist attacks in 1993. First, a guy by the name of Kanzi from Pakistan applies for political asylum, lying through his teeth, and repays our generosity by shooting up the CIA, killing two CIA officers and wounding three others, and 1 month later, the first attack at the Trade Center. Same story, aliens who game the visa process and the immigration benefits program. Now, as to who said it, this paragraph is the actual first paragraph in the preface to the 9/11 Commission staff report on terrorist travel. These were the folks who worked with the 9/11 Commission. They were attorneys and agents and support personnel who put together this volume, which, by the way, is available for free online. You don't have to pay a penny for it. Just go online. You can go to my website, michaelcutler.net. I've written about it extensively. And here's what they said. If you can't secure the border, you can't protect the country. This isn't rocket science. You know, when
no,
we buy a house,
when
you rent
sense.
An apartment, don't they give you a peephole and a doorbell on your front door so when a stranger rings the bell, you can make a conscious decision as to whether or not it's a good idea to let that stranger into your home?
Exactly. Right. Yes.
Doesn't that work for you?
Yeah, and it works for Americans, which is, I think, why they're concerned about it, because they don't see it happening at the national level. So I think we've really got a few weeks here to maybe try to stop this thing, Mike. I think it's really come down to the final crunch here, because I'm reading some comments the president made today, and he's sounding confident to me, and so are these Democratic leaders that are pushing it. So the Gang of Eight is confident, and
I call them the Eight
All
gangs,
I know is
right.
It would be catastrophic if it passes.
Well, you know, and I'll tell you, it would mean that Obama will have delivered on his promise to change America, but not for the better. You know, when he was offering change, people said, "Don't you want change?" And I had my real issues with George W. Bush. You know, we secure the Iraqi border by sending Border Patrol agents to Iraq and left our border wide open. It was one of those moments where you sit there scratching your head. We can go on for quite a while about things I disagreed with. But people said, "Well, don't you want change?" I said, "Well, let me tell you what I worry about. Supposing you and I right now were sitting in a lifeboat, the ocean liner we were in just capsized, it went down. We are in frigid, shark-infested waters, and you're complaining to the guy sitting across from you, 'Man, I'm getting seasick, I am cold, I am hungry, I feel like garbage. Man, I wish someone could do something to change my circumstances.' And imagine if that guy is so tired of hearing you complain that he throws you into the frigid, shark-infested waters. Well, you certainly would have gotten your situation changed, but I don't think it's a change for the better. How does that work for you?
Right. Exactly. So it's that's what we're looking at right now. And what I find, and I'd like to get your thoughts on this, what I find
sure.
interesting is a lot of money is really flowing into this whole debate, Mike. And you got people like Mark Zuckerberg and his group. I mean, they're just flooding talk radio with all these commercials and trying to really convey the message that conservatives and Republicans are joining with Democrats, and this is sort of a unity bill, and this is something that is going to be, you know, good for all Americans.
And we're all going to sing Kumbaya.
Right, right.
You know, here's a couple of thoughts I have. Now, one of the arguments that we hear is that if we don't import foreign entrepreneurs, America is done. Stick a fork in it, it's over, right? Mr. Zuckerberg is certainly an entrepreneur.
Right.
Would you agree?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Bill Gates, entrepreneur?
Yes.
Mike Bloomberg, mayor of New York, a guy that I've come to despise, entrepreneur?
Yes.
Okay. Where were they born?
They were all born right here.
So now explain to me how a bunch of American entrepreneur gazillionaires have the chutzpah, as we say in Brooklyn, to say
right.
that we've got to import entrepreneurs because we don't make them like we used to here in the United States.
Don't forget Steve Jobs. They're getting ready to do a big
movie
about him.
Absolutely. And by the way, Elon Musk, who was born in South Africa, and you know, PayPal and SpaceX and the electric car company that he has, certainly the epitome of the entrepreneur. Well, the process worked, and he was admitted so that he could do his thing here in the United States.
Right.
So what exactly is it we're striving for? And let me tell you, I'll tell you what's going on. By the way, I don't call them the Gang of Eight. I call them the Eight Gangsters. And continuing with this idea about the Eight Gangsters, Jeff, think about Mike Bloomberg. He had a better racket going than Tony Soprano and Protection. You know, the mob offers to protect you from themselves. You know, you pay me $50 a week, I won't throw a brick through your window. Well,
right.
Mike Bloomberg had a better deal going. He said, listen, we have a sanctuary city here in New York, and the result of it is we are so congested that there are times that I've gotten stuck in midtown traffic where, you know, you drive for an hour and you cover three blocks and you're sucking in fumes the whole time. Very unpleasant. And this is in part because we are overflowing with people who probably some of them shouldn't be here. So what's Mike Bloomberg's solution to the mess he created? Congestion pricing. I'm going to charge you for the privilege as a New Yorker. You're already paying real estate tax on your home, but if you want to drive into Midtown Manhattan, I'm going to make you pay for it, just for the privilege of sucking fumes in Midtown Manhattan. I mean, I think that's a better racket than protection. But I'll tell you where it all stems from, and it stems from an individual by the name of Alan Greenspan. You know, I was so frustrated listening to Greenspan. This was April 30th, 2009. I saw the hearing by dumb luck. I was just, you know, checking out what was going on. And I said, oh, my gosh, they're having a hearing on immigration. And the title of the hearing was Comprehensive Immigration Reform in 2009. Can we do it and how? And I wrote a commentary where I said that it reminded me of the apocryphal law firm, Do We Cheat 'Em and How? And
and
I was on a radio show the next day, and the woman whose show it was said, what'd you think of Greenspan? I said, well, I thought while I watched him that I was witnessing a first. She said, what sort of first? I said, it was the first time I'd seen somebody testify while suffering from rigor mortis. Because his style is amazing. When you watch the pharmaceutical commercials, the disclaimer is rattled off by somebody who could get a job at the Mecum Auto Auction in his spare time. It's 100 miles an hour, and you can't understand what he's saying. Greenspan, on the other hand, has this flat, dead voice, monotone that drones on forever. It sounds like syrup pouring across the table. And I started to listen to what he said, and I said, you know, I can't believe that he said what he said. I must have misunderstood him. And what's interesting, folks, and for those of you who've never done this, go to the websites of Congress and the Senate, because they post these videos, they post the testimony. And it was remarkable at some of the things that he had actually had the brass to say. he talked about how it's great to have illegal aliens as part of the workforce, because he said it was a flexible workforce that would expand and contract with the needs of our society. Never mind that if you go to Title 8, United States Code, Section 1182, it talks about who we're supposed to keep out. Aliens with dangerous communicable diseases, aliens who are mentally ill and violent or sex offenders, convicted felons, gang members, gun runners, drug traffickers, the list goes on and on. Never mind that it includes terrorists, spies, human rights violators, and war criminals. Never mind that it includes aliens who would become public charges. Never mind that it would involve aliens who would work illegally, thereby displacing American workers who can't find jobs, and also have the added bonus, quote-unquote, of driving down wages. But it's exactly over the issue of driving down wages that puts a sparkle in old Greenspan's ugly eyes. Because what he talked about is the need to, number one, bring in more people, believe it or not, from other countries to buy up vacant housing units, which means people's homes that were lost to foreclosure. He actually said that. Because he said that if you brought these people in, it would help, believe it or not. Well, let me read it to you, because you won't believe this, Jeff. First, skilled workers and their families form new households. They will, of necessity, move into vacant housing units, the current glut of which is depressing prices of American homes. And, of course, house price declines are a major factor in mortgage foreclosures and the plunge in value of the vast quantity of U.S. mortgage-backed securities that has contributed substantially to the disabling of our banking system. Well, what he left out was that 4 years earlier, in 2005, he went before the Federal Reserve Bank as chairman and bragged about the subprime mortgages he was providing to illegal aliens and then splitting up the risk through that process that they developed so that nobody would face a real serious risk, right, until the whole market collapsed. So here he's saying we could support the housing market and provide profit to the banks by flooding the housing market with foreign workers who could buy up the houses and get the price of real estate to go up. Then he said, and this is what really lit my fuse, the second bonus of increasing the number of high-tech workers, H-1B visas and the like, and he specified H-1Bs, by the way, earlier in his testimony, the second bonus would address the increasing concentration of income in this country. Greatly expanding our quotas for the highly skilled would lower wage premiums of skilled over lesser skilled. Wage premiums, my backside, the salaries of workers is what he's talking about. And he went on and said, skill shortages in America exist because we are shielding our skilled labor force from world competition. Quotas have been substituted for the wage pricing mechanism. And in the process, we have created a privileged elite. How do you like that word? Privileged elite, whose incomes are being supported at non-competitively high levels by immigration quotas on skilled professionals. Eliminating such restrictions would reduce at least some of our income inequality. Now, it's remarkable because when we hear income inequality, America is about equality. And here he says we have to fight inequality. So if you're not paying attention, it sounds like a good thing. Well, look at it this way, folks. If it's income inequality because one guy is black, the other guy is white, and the one guy gets more than the other, of course that's wrong. If it's a woman versus a man doing the same exact job, if the woman's making less money, of course that's wrong. So inequality and income, well, we got to fight that. But that wasn't what he was saying. He was talking about income inequality based on skill. That's the heart of the American dream. Acquire a skill, become a tradesman, or get a college degree, and then you can command a better salary. And Greenspan looks at that and says, not so fast. If we could flood the labor market with this commodity of foreign labor, we could drive down the wages so that the salary, the wage premium, the extra money that God knows what these wealthy middle-class people are doing with all that money, we could narrow the gap. so that you will not make much more money whether you have a degree or you drop out of high school.
Well, and let me chime in here if I could, because
sure,
I
didn't mean to go on this one, but I just needed to make this point to you and my listeners.
I did a report on the recent unemployment rate.
Yep.
And I noticed that the average wage of the American people, the American worker, is actually down. The average
work week
is actually down. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, if this is accelerated, I mean, it is going to harm the American worker big time. I mean, we already have a labor situation that is catastrophic. You've got 90 million Americans that aren't working, that are out of the labor force. You had 37,000 that just added to that figure last month. You've got 77% of all the new jobs during the Obama years are part-time. You have people that are struggling to make ends meet. I don't know what Alan Greenspan is smoking about, you know, wages being too high.
Oh, no, you know what he's
smoking.
This is about more money for the people at the very top rung. What's happening, in my judgment, and tell me if you disagree with me, Jeff. See, rather than Mexico looking at America and saying we need to be more like America, the very wealthy in America, the Zuckerbergs and all these billionaires, not millionaires, but billionaires, are looking longingly at Mexico and saying, wow, if I was here, I could be like that guy Slim. I could be living in an oligarchy where I could have twice as much wealth as I have now. Now, God only knows, if you're worth $50 billion, we have to pass the hat.
Right.
If you have 11 mansions, God only knows, you need that 12th mansion. If you're flying around the world in a Gulfstream 5, God knows, you need a 737. I mean,
well,
this is insanity.
I know Carlos Slim is doing quite well, thanks to Mr. Obama. This whole Obama phone deal has really put a lot of money in his pocket. I mean, it's just another scam we got going on.
As did NAFTA.
Yeah.
And think about how they brought out all those old presidents. They were drooling all over themselves, whether it was Gerald Ford or Jimmy Carter, Ronald Reagan. Or who, you know, it's both sides of the aisle, folks. I'm an equal opportunity kind of guy. And they stood there drooling on themselves, saying, oh, NAFTA, great, let's do it. And I remember a New York talk show guy on CBS radio came on and said, NAFTA, we don't have to. And, you know,
well,
he was
I remember
right.
A guy named Ross Perot who was fighting NAFTA tooth and nail. And he said it was going to be the great sucking sound was going to be heard. And I think he's been proven right, Mike.
He was. And, you know, I compare what's going on, and I wrote a piece for a wonderful quarterly magazine, The Social Contract. And, in fact, the next edition, the summer of this year's edition, is coming out, I think, next week, from what I understand. And I did a piece on how fraud and the political asylum process undermines national security. I'll get to that in a sec. But I wrote a piece about the people who profit from illegal immigration and even the legal side of it. And it's amazing. I called it immigration, the modern-day gold rush. And what you're looking at are the banks, the immigration lawyers, the various advocacy organizations, realtors. Again, you can see why the real estate business, colleges. Everybody's got a finger in the pie, and no one cares about what it does to the average American. I spoke to a former high official within the immigration agencies. And this guy had the brass to say to me that I had an antiquated concept because he wanted to help move businesses from China to the Caribbean. And I said, why move it to the Caribbean? Move it to the United States. Well, corporations don't want to do business in the United States because then they have to pay taxes. And that's fine. He said, America can do well even if Americans are not doing well. This guy was a naturalized citizen, by the way. And I said to him, well, you may have taken an oath of citizenship, but it's probably as meaningless to you as anything else that you've said in jest. And I went ballistic. I said, how in the world can you say to me with a straight face that America can do well when Americans aren't doing well? And you look at the way they cook the books. I think they've given Bernie Madoff part-time work. I mean, you can't get a full-time job, even in jail these days, I guess. So they gave Bernie Madoff a part-time job in jail to cook the labor books. 7.4% unemployment? Really?
Well, that's,
we all know
that's a joke. We all know that's a joke. I mean, that rate doesn't make any sense.
It's probably
closer to
25%.
You talk to people out on the street. I'm talking to my listeners every day. People are having a hard time. Prices are going up. Wages are not. People are being squeezed. They see this immigration bill coming down the pike. That's going to make things even more difficult. Obamacare is coming. That's going to be problematic. People are worried about that. We look all the way around. People are very, very anxious, I think, about this economy. And I'm worried about this country. I really am. And I think this bill has got to be stopped. We have got to pull together and somehow stop this bill. And I have no faith, Mike, in John Boehner. I've got no faith in the Republican leadership. I think they're weak.
Well, Boehner is the problem.
Yeah.
Boehner is the bane, let me tell you. Because understand what's wrong with Boehner. He is a Chamber of Commerce guy. And the Chamber of Commerce has formed an organization known as the Discover America Partnership. And they have partnered with the hotel, hospitality, tourism, and travel industries, and now manufacturing associations have come on board. And you know what they want? More visa waiver countries. Do you know why? Because the more people that they bring here, the more money that the people in those industries can make. And what I compare this to is what we saw with cancer. You know, cancer has an insatiable appetite for nutrients. A malignant tumor even grows its own network of blood vessels so it can bathe itself in nutrients, not unlike what we see the mega wealthy do. And I'm not against being wealthy. It depends on how you get the money. You know, I love to see people that are successful, but, you know, drug dealers and pimps and the like are not successful in my Cutler world. And so if you're taking money by undermining the economy of the United States, if you are destroying the American dream for Americans, then I don't have any respect for how you got the money, because as far as I'm concerned, you're a scoundrel. And so you look at the way a cancerous tumor operates, and then you look at these unscrupulous bums, and you know, cancer does really, really well right up until the day it kills its victim. And these thugs are going to do really well until, God forbid, they kill America. And they don't see it any more than a malignant tumor doesn't see its own demise coming. What do you think of that analogy, Joe?
I think that's a great analogy. I think that's an absolutely on-target analogy. And I think our country is at stake. I really do. And that's why I think this is a critical, critical debate. But the reason I mentioned John Boehner is that obviously this thing has passed the Senate. Obviously it's now before the House. Boehner is the guy who could stop it if he wanted. But he seems to be now sort of folding his cards, and it looks like to me that this thing is going to go through. I mean, I don't know what your analysis is, but every day that goes by, I have less confidence in John Boehner.
Oh, I have no confidence in Boehner. I'm hoping that other good people in Congress will stop him. When Goodlatte says this is wrong, I have a little bit of confidence. I hope that Goodlatte will put his money where his mouth is. I have to tell you, here's an amazing article, and I wrote this for Caps, and I quoted a guy by Zuckerman. Zuckerman, of course, is the chairman and editor-in-chief of U.S. News and World Report. And here's how he described the growing economic crisis in America. And it's a remarkable, because he'll never talk about immigration either. They identify the crisis, but then they don't want to look at what really will cure the disease. He said, this is Zuckerman now speaking, and this was February 1st of this year. Today, millions are assisted by checks from Social Security and by food stamps. Food stamp enrollment has been rising at the rate of 400,000 per month. More than 47 million Americans now depend on that program, an almost incredible record, for it is 15% of the population compared with the 7.9% who received food stamps from 1970 to 2000. Meanwhile, nearly 11 million Americans are now collecting federal disability checks from Social Security, and half have signed on since President Obama came to office. In 1992, there was one person on disability for every 35 workers. Today, it is one for every 16. Such an increase simply cannot have been caused by the direct disability experienced during employment. This is, in effect, another unemployment program, one without end, and many of the people on disability would normally be considered unemployed. And he went on and made the point also that during the Depression, it was easy to see the poor. They were wearing torn clothing, waiting on long lines to get bread or soup. Today, they sit home and wait for a check.
Yeah, that's a great point. That's a great point. And look, every month we're getting more and more of them.
Yes, and he said this is as bad, if not worse, than the Great Depression. Now, here's something that nobody stops to think about, so I'll give you something to think about. And I tried to get onto a couple of the Fox programs, because I appear on Fox fairly frequently. One of the producers didn't want to talk about it the day I called, and I was so darn angry I wanted to chuck my phone out the window. They were talking about unemployment. And I said to this guy, do you know how many legal workers we admit, foreign legal workers who are authorized to work every month? And he said, no. I said, do you know we're admitting more foreign workers than the number of jobs we're creating? American workers are running up a down escalator that's picking up speed. And he said, are you sure about that? I said, yes. And here's how it works. Every year we admit over 1 million lawful immigrants. Now, it's true they don't all work. Many of them are kids. But the child of today, 15 years from now, will be of the age to join the labor force, God willing. Now, the kids that came in 15 years ago are no longer kids. They are now in the age to join the labor force. So it's a conveyor belt. It's like sprinkling seedlings. You know, you're planting a forest. And, yes, it's a seedling today, but in 15 years, that seedling will be a shade tree. So if you look at that conveyor belt and you just look at the immigrants, we're admitting almost 1 million a year. That works out to 90-odd thousand per month. Now, we are also admitting over 400,000 foreign students every year into the United States, most of whom get practical training. That means work. So now we're adding 400,000 per year who are students over that. In fact, I think 2 years ago it was 470,000. Then you've got the exchange visitor program that accounts for, I don't know how many more, hundreds of thousands. And then you've got the H-1B visas, and then you've got the agricultural workers, and you have other foreign workers as well. We are probably admitting between 150 to 200,000 legal foreign workers every month, and that does not include the illegal aliens. How do you think this is going to end?
Not well.
Am I crazy, Jeff? Is my analysis wrong?
Of course not. I mean, you know the figures, and you're exactly right. I don't think Americans realize how many legal immigrants are coming in here, Mike.
I mean, those are
figures. And again, I have a caller who challenges me every day on the air when I bring up immigration. He says that all of us who want to control this and worry about border security are somehow racist, and we're trying to protect our culture, and we don't want to be accepting of Hispanic culture, and I tell him, I mean, we are doing a very
Hispanic culture. This is interesting. By the way, do you know what the greatest influx of legal workers is from where they come from?
I would say Mexico.
China.
Okay.
See, there is so many lies. And, I mean, look, you look at Chuck Schumer, and he's a liar. Chuck, if you're listening, your nose is growing. Get a nose job. You can use some plastic surgery anyway. He used to be my congressman. He was never my representative, and I'm a lifelong Democrat. You know, I met with Chuck Schumer in 1985 when they were concocting comprehensive immigration reform. Back then it was called, I'm trying to remember the term for it, the Immigration Reform and Control Act, IRCA. And he had come up with this plan for the farm workers. And I had a meeting with him, and it was difficult for me to go to the meeting. My first wife at the time was dying of cancer. She was 33, and our son was about a year old. And she felt so strongly about what I was doing. She was a computer whiz. She had her MBA in computer science. And she said to me, go have your meeting with Schumer. I'll be okay. And the guy wouldn't meet with me for more than 11 minutes. I had a 15-minute meeting when I started telling him what it was about. He said, let me tell you what I know. You don't meet with a member of Congress to find out what they know. You meet with them to tell them what you're concerned about.
Right, exactly.
And, you know, I had worked with Senator Al D'Amato and expected a similar reaction. Al D'Amato sat down with me for a couple of hours. Al D'Amato worked with me to change the reentry law to make reentry after deportations for criminal aliens a separate and distinct crime with a 20-year max, not the 2-year max that had been the law before. Because of it, immigration criminal prosecutions now rank as the number one prosecution across the country in the federal criminal justice system. So, you know, I said, well, if I can meet with a senator, and his staff worked with me over a period of 6 months, maybe almost a year, actually. And Wednesday nights, I would go to his Midtown office, and they always had coffee mm-hmm. and a sandwich and Danish waiting for me. So I expected the same.
Right.
And Schumer walks into the room, looks at me, and says, what do you want to talk about? I told him, he said, let me tell you what I know. And I said, why are you doing this? I said, you don't even have a farm in your district. He looked at his watch. He said, your time is up. My next appointment here, it's time for you to leave. And, of course,
that's
we all know that Anthony
yeah.
Weiner was Chuck Schumer's protege. So this is what we're
mm-hmm.
dealing with. And so understand the problem, folks. This isn't about xenophobia. I'm Jewish. My mom came here ahead of the Holocaust. I'm a New Yorker. If I was xenophobic, why in the world would I live in New York, the most ethnically diverse city in all of America? It's not that I
yeah.
don't want diversity. I don't want crime. I don't want terrorists. And I don't want to see American workers find it impossible to work.
But
you know,
Mike,
the
reason I brought that up is that it's one of the arguments that the supporters use all the time.
Oh, I know. Let me tell you what
somehow
happened.
Racist, right, xenophobic,
well, let me tell you what happened.
Et cetera.
I got to
mm-hmm.
tell you this, Jeff. I was in Washington with the Black American Leadership Alliance on July 15th to protest against comprehensive reform. And afterwards, I was with Stuart Varney over at Fox News. He was filling in for Neil Cavuto. I'm on with Neil fairly regularly these days. And I said, look, in 86, when we legalized almost 4 million, they were no longer subject to exploitation. So their unscrupulous bosses who hired them because they were able to exploit them, they could no longer exploit them, they fired them. So they went on welfare, they went on unemployment, and they began competing with American workers for jobs. And so it created a problem. And in fact, we got unlimited phone calls from the newly legalized aliens screaming bloody murder that they went back to their boss with their magic card and said, look, I want to be paid on the books and more than $5 an hour. I want prevailing wages. And they were fired. Well,
wow.
Within a day, Media Matters and a couple of others of these Looney Tune websites said, Mike Cutler mm-hmm. opposes comprehensive reform because it would end exploitation of immigrants. Can you imagine that one?
Well, I know Media Matters, and that's pretty much par for the course for Media Matters.
But then ABC News reached out to me because they formed something called Fusion, where they've apparently partnered with Univision.
Mm.
And their reporter sent me an email and said, did you or did you not say that? I said, that's not what I said. Well, what did you say? And I had, in fact, rather than write, I called them up. And I said, the point I made is that once these folks were no longer subject to exploitation, they got fired. And they complained about being fired. So in other words, by legalizing them, they couldn't be exploited anymore. I said, yeah, they didn't have their jobs anymore either. Yeah, but so in other words, that's exactly what you said. I said, no, that's not what I said. And then we got into an argument of how many aliens were involved, and it went downhill quickly from there. And I basically said, I give up, and I hung up on the guy. You know,
wow.
What's going on, this is why we can't use the word alien. You know, and something interesting happened. There was a program on, I think it was Nat Geo, National Geographic, about the history of the mob. And Joe Gallo, crazy Joe Gallo, who actually got shot at Umberto's clam barn in Little Italy in 1972, I guess. In 1970, he created the Italian-American Civil Rights League, I believe is what it was called. And he pressured politicians and judges and the media to stop using the term mafia. And they interviewed
right.
Rudy Giuliani, who said, boy, that's some clout. So now we're seeing the same sort of thing. We're not allowed to use the word alien. It's not an insult. It just means any person who's not a citizen or national. It's about twisting the facts so that people
well,
can then make these accusations and try to intimidate.
But, you know, they've done that with the language in so many different areas. It's the sort of political correctness that we see where we can't use certain words because it's supposedly offensive and... You know, it's just part of what's happening all across our country, Mike. And, you know, that's one thing that I'm fighting on my program, this politically correct sort of culture that we have and this government. And it's sort of an assault on people like myself that have traditional values and that, you know, are flag wavers, you know, red, white, and blue. Yep. We believe in this country. We love this country. And we're very sick about what is happening to this country.
But you see, I think if people really understood the issue, I went to Central Washington University outside Seattle about 6 years ago. Amazing experience. We had a bunch of demonstrators, about 500 people and about 30 or 40 demonstrators. Jeff, would you believe it if I tell you by the time I got done, the protesters were hugging me and asked if I would take a picture with them or give them an autograph?
Really?
Because they came to
you
realize
won them
they
over,
were,
huh?
Yes, because they realized they were being lied to. Understand something. If you look at what goes on by not controlling immigration, we are allowing criminals to set up shop in hundreds of cities across America. The Mexican cartels, Asian organized crime, the Jamaican drug posses, and so forth. The most likely victim of violence and extortion are the members of the immigrant communities, irrespective of where they come from, because the tactics are the same. Because these thugs, these transnational criminals, are able to reach back into the home country and do harm to family members of the immigrants living in the United States. So they go up to some guy and they say, hey, Igor, I want you to take this package to my friend in Los Angeles. He says, well, what am I, your courier? Yes, as a matter of fact, you are. What's in the suitcase? None of your business. I'm going to lock it, and if it doesn't get there in one piece, I will visit your sister. We know where she lives in Leningrad. And we pay her a visit tomorrow night. You know what they now have? They have a courier.
What's that?
They have a courier. Mm-hmm. And this goes on, whether it's the Mexicans, the Russians, the Israelis, the Italian. Right. Understand who's being hurt. The people most vulnerable are the immigrant communities. And why in the world are we worried about helping foreign students when American kids can't succeed? You know, put a bright kid into bad circumstances, and I saw it as an agent. I spent half my career with the Drug Task Force. You take a kid living in a ghetto situation, and he's bright, and he doesn't want to live in housing where there's roaches and rats running around, where bullets are flying through his window at night. What won't that kid do to get out of that kind of poverty? And if he has no legitimate outlet for his desires for success, then he becomes another crime statistic himself, does he not?
Yeah, we see it in urban areas all over, and we see it in cities like Detroit that have failed. I wanted to mention one thing you talked about.
Sure.
Our students, you know, I think that we're now looking at a situation where our young people are finishing college, they're finding out that they don't have job prospects, they're having to live at home with their parents, and they're loaded with massive amounts of student debt that they're not going to be able to pay off for years. So what I think it's leading to is more and more folks not seeing why they should even go to college, not being able to afford college.
Right.
And we've got one here in the New Orleans area, Loyola, that just experienced this past year, Mike, a 30% drop in enrollment. And
well,
I think that trend's going to continue.
Oh, absolutely. And people are now saying to these kids, why in the world are you bothering with college if it's not going to give you a job? And you've got Greenspan saying that that's the way it should be. Even if you get the education, you shouldn't make any more money. Aim low, you know, not aim high, aim low.
Well, a lot of people are aiming low because there's nothing else. And that's really the sad thing. I mean, we used to have the American dream here, Mike, where people felt like, you know, the next generation is going to do better than their parents' generation.
Yep,
and I don't see
that
continuing anymore.
Well, and so the American people need to be selfish, and they need to say to themselves, how is this going to affect me and my children? Forget, I mean, because a lot of people, unfortunately, are grammatically challenged. They can only conjugate verbs in the first person singular, you know? So let them conjugate those verbs in the first person singular and ask yourself, if you have children and they go to college, and they spend a ton of money on education and put off getting a job for years, which is also another source of financial drain. I mean, you know, the kid with a high school diploma who drives a garbage truck, there's nothing wrong with driving a garbage truck, don't misunderstand me, but that kid will do better than the kid with a degree who has no job. Because the kid driving the garbage truck started working when he was 18, and he's now invested in a pension plan that maybe the city will be able to pay when he's eligible to retire. Who knows? But the point is, he's working today. The kid sitting in a classroom isn't working and spending money.
The other one's
going
to have loads of debt as well. No job and plenty of debt. Right.
So, I mean, how is that going to play out? And now you add to that the fact that we are awash with gangs in America, with increasing amounts of narcotics being sold in America. You know, when Nappy said that the border is secure, I was on with Neil Cavuto, and he said, well, the number of people being arrested by the Border Patrol is down, so it means that there's fewer people. I said, forget that nonsense. I don't trust those statistics any more than I would trust Bernie Madoff auditing somebody's checkbook. I said, you know, I said, trying to figure out how many illegals are here based on how many people the Border Patrol arrests is like taking attendance and asking people not present to raise their hand.
Right.
Now, you know what the real metric is for figuring out how secure the border is, Jeff? What's happening to the price of drugs? Because cocaine and heroin and quite a bit of the meth and marijuana as well are imported, smuggled into the United States. Now, if the border was secure, those chemicals, those poisons wouldn't be getting in. Supply and demand kicks in. If the demand stays the same and it's actually going up, what should happen to the price? It should go through the roof. Instead, the price of the drugs is dropping. So what does that tell you?
Wow. Lots of supply.
That's
huh?
the metric. What do you think of that metric?
So, I mean, that seems like that's what's happening. So let me ask you this. I hear a figure that some experts have told me, and I want to get your view on this, that we really only have about 36 miles of double fencing on the southern border right now. Is that accurate?
I don't know. But let me tell you why I almost don't care. I mean, I do care, but I don't care. Forgive me for this. By the way, I'm in a film called Freedom Under Fire Part 2. They came to New York, my friends from North Carolina, my friend Mark Hager, who's a history professor, and some of his buddies. And I took them to where drugs are being sold and the money is being moved out. The money wire services are running 24/7 now. We drove by at 1 o'clock in the morning. It could have been 1 o'clock in the afternoon. That's how big the traffic through the area was. But if you want to, if you watch the movie, and I'll send you the link, and if anybody wants to contact me through the website, I'll send you the link. It's free. It's a 40-minute film. They went down to the border. They leave the gates open. These are gates that rise up, and you could drive trucks underneath. They leave them open for months at a time, and there's nobody patrolling the area. So does it matter if there's a fence there? But what happened when they came here, I said, you know, New York is a triple border state between New York and New Jersey. If you look at the coastline and you look at the seaport, Port Newark, if you look at the fact that we have John F. Kennedy International Airport and Newark International Airport, and then if you go up to the Canadian border, New York shares the part of the border with Canada. Mm-hmm. We went to Port Newark and they filmed. And what you saw as far as you could see were cargo containers stacked one on top of the other like bricks forever. See, everyone thinks that the drugs are only coming across the Mexican border. Back in 1971, when I started as an immigration inspector, we back then had people swallowing heroin in condoms and balloons. Now when they find it on the Mexican border, it was a big deal because they have the thing Border Wars. They had this very pretty DEA supervisor come on, and she was talking about, oh, my God, a new phenomenon. Well, let me tell you, it's been going on at Kennedy Airport at least since the 70s. So the drugs and the illegal aliens are pouring into the United States.
Everywhere.
We have 95,000 miles of coastline, Jeff.
Mm-hmm.
So a boat goes out with five sailors on it, five fishermen, and it comes back with 38 fishermen on it. Who's going to notice when the boat pulls in at 3 o'clock in the morning?
Now, what about this whole nonsense that the immigration reform bill includes more border security, more border patrol agents, more funding for the border? I mean, is that just hocus-pocus, or is that
hocus-pocus.
Real?
Hocus-pocus, and I'm going to tell you why. You ask the average person what really needs to be done for interior enforcement. So understand the problem with interior enforcement right now. There is no interior enforcement, okay? Now, and if you say to people, what do you mean by interior enforcement? First of all, we only have 7,000 ICE agents for the whole country. and more than half of them are doing customs work, not immigration work. You're lucky if there are 3,000 immigration agents for the entire United States of America. Let's put that in perspective. New York City has between 35,000 and 40,000 police officers, depending on what year, because of attrition and hirings and so forth. It bounces between 35,000 to 42,000. We are at low ebb right now, and everyone's wringing their hands saying, oh, my God, crime may go up because we don't have enough cops. 35,000 cops for New York City, which I think encompasses like around 300 square miles. We have less than 10% that number for ICE agents for the whole country. And some people say, well, if we had mandatory E-Verify, then we're okay. Not really. I'll tell you why not. If we're giving people identity documents and employment authorization without even a face-to-face interview, once you give them an employment authorization document, guess what? They will easily pass E-Verify. Let me read another paragraph from that 9/11 Commission staff report.
Okay.
It's a short one. Once terrorists had entered the United States, their next challenge was to find a way to remain here. Their primary method was immigration fraud. When was the last time you heard anybody talk about immigration fraud?
Been a long
time. Never, okay? For example, Yusuf, and that's Ramzi Yusuf, and Ajaj concocted bogus political asylum stories when they arrived in the United States. Mahmoud Abu Alima, involved in both the World Trade Center and landmark plots, received temporary residence under the Seasonal Agricultural Worker Program. That's Chucky Baby's program. After falsely claiming he'd picked beans in Florida. The only thing this guy ever planted was a bomb in the garage of the World Trade Center. And then we flip forward to page 98, the same report, 9/11 Commission staff report on terrorist travel, and catch this. Terrorists in the 1990s, as well as the September 11th hijackers, needed to find a way to stay in or embed themselves in the United States if their operational plans were to come to fruition. As already discussed, this could be accomplished legally by marrying an American citizen, achieving temporary worker status, think of the Dreamers, right, or applying for asylum after entering. In many cases, the act of filing for an immigration benefit sufficed to permit the alien to remain in the country until the petition was adjudicated. Terrorists were free to conduct surveillance, coordinate operations, obtain and receive funding, go to school and learn English, make contacts in the United States, acquire necessary materials, and execute an attack.
So they can just sort of stay here indefinitely, right? I mean, just one.
And nobody is looking for people who overstay. And you know what? Do you remember, Jeff, when two of the dead terrorists, Mohammed Atta and Marwan al-Shehhi, were granted authorization to attend flight school 6 months after the attacks? I was one of the four witnesses.
I do know this, Mike. I wrote a column a few months back about Obama's uncle Omar.
Right.
And if I'm not mistaken, he should have been sent out of this country, what, about a decade ago, 15 years ago?
Yes, I agree. But forget about Obama. Look at those two dead terrorists. 6 months after 9/11, they were given authorization to go to flight school. So by then, the whole world knew that they had been terrorists and they were dead. I was one of the four witnesses called by the House Judiciary Committee to testify at that fiasco of a hearing. It was one of, I think I've now done 16 congressional hearings, Jeff. So
right.
You would think they've tightened up on the foreign students. Wrong. Do you know that right now more than 10,000 schools are authorized to bring in foreign students? Do you know that right now there are more than 850,000 foreign students in the United States? Do you think anyone's really tracking them? Look at what happened. I was just on with Megyn Kelly on May 2nd. Those two guys that were involved with the Tsarnaev brothers, and by the way, that family, it would appear, lied on their application for political asylum. It would appear. I'm not sure. Someone should really investigate it. To get political asylum, you have to claim credible fear. If you send me back home because of my race, because of my ethnicity, my tribe, my religion, my political views, I will face persecution or worse. Well, they said credible fear. We gave them political asylum. And what did they do right after they got asylum? They went back to Russia. So how credible was their fear? And meanwhile, the two students, so-called, who got rid of the evidence, the explosives and the backpacks and the computers, are now being charged with obstruction of governmental administration. At least one of them was no longer attending school when we readmitted him as a student, even though he had dropped out of school months earlier.
Which shows that we're not tracking anything effectively, even though
Nothing. We're
tracking everybody's phone number and everybody's email.
Yes,
we've got
and
all
I'll
this
give you
data.
A worse one.
We're not
I'll
using it well.
One,
Mike,
though.
Unfortunately, my friend, I got a roll right now because
right.
I've got a 7 o'clock appointment. But
okay.
I do want to just say I've enjoyed it tremendously, and I look forward to having you on my program on Monday.
Absolutely. Just to let you know, and I'm going to let you roll, they've lost track of people in the Witness Protection Program who were terrorists. They gave them new identities and didn't tell the people who compiled the no-fly list what their new names are.
Amazing.
So
Mike, thank you, my friend.
Yes, but I look forward to seeing you on Monday.
Yes, sir, and thanks for the opportunity, and we'll talk on Monday. Take care.
Absolutely. Have a great weekend. Thanks right, for
bye.
Joining me.
You too. Bye-bye.
Yep, bye-bye, Jeff. You know, folks, it was great having Jeff on with me this evening. I'm certainly looking forward to joining him on his program. But this is the problem that we're dealing with. And you know, what Jeff was just talking about is exactly right. The threat that we are now facing is that if the Congress comes up with comprehensive reform, as I wrote in a recent commentary, there will be no going back. There will be no do-overs. If we start to legalize millions of illegal aliens whose true names, countries of citizenship, dates of entry, you know, well, we got to make sure these people have been here at least for 3 years or 5 years or 2 years, whatever. It's all meaningless if you can't verify the data that is contained in applications. And I will tell you that they will not be interviewing these folks in person. And if you can't conduct something as basic as a face-to-face interview, I can also tell you they will not be able to do any field investigations. So anything that these people write on an application will be presumed to be honest and accurate. Presumed to be honest and accurate. And we all know that terrorists and criminals never lie. Isn't that right? This is a very perilous situation that we're in, folks. As of this morning, according to news reports, they have evacuated personnel from the U.S. Embassy at Lahore, Pakistan. Other embassies and consulates are closed. This is unprecedented. We're being told that the risk of a terror attack is real, potentially imminent. There have been many more drone strikes being carried out in the Middle East, which may fire up more anti-American sentiment. We are in a vicious spiral, taking measures over there and doing nothing over here. In the days and weeks after 9/11, and this went on for quite some time, it went on for a couple of years, in fact, people running for office were saying, we're fighting them over there so we don't have to fight them over here. This is the country of the slogan. Rudy Giuliani, when he ran for president, said, we're fighting them over there so we don't have to fight them over here. George W. Bush said the same thing. John McCain said, we're going to fight them over there so we don't have... And I listen to these words, and what in the world does it mean that we're fighting them over there so we don't have to fight them over here? Are we not fighting them over here if people getting on airplanes have to be all but stripped naked? Are we not fighting them over here if the NSA is spying on everybody who makes a phone call or goes on the internet? Are we not fighting them over here when you look at how the Fourth Amendment has been shredded in the name of national security? Now, look, let me be very clear. I do a lot of travel. I don't want to get a window seat on a cruise missile. So let's be honest about it. We want to be safe. But are these measures not evidence of fighting them over here? And when the World Trade Center was reduced to rubble, the last time I looked at a map, Lower Manhattan was over here. The Pentagon is over here. And that field in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, is certainly over here as well. But we live in a society where people seize on some slogan, like Winston tastes good like a cigarette should, and we tend to think that this is the way it is. Well, we heard the president say it. The president says, everybody wants me to do this. Everybody wants that. Everybody who? What number is everybody? He talked to three people? That's what we seem to be hearing from politicians across the board. Crazy assertions, crazy slogans. When you stop to dissect and analyze the slogans, they make no sense. How in the world can you say that we're going to fight the terrorists over there, not fight them over here, but meanwhile, America today is nothing like it was before 9/11. I think that if somebody in the year 2000, pardon me, could see the dance that we go through just to get on board an airplane, they'd be astonished. The X-ray machines, God only knows if we're not getting dosed with too much radiation, the intrusive searches, all kinds of crazy stuff in the name of national security, but we're being told, oh, we're fighting them over there, so we don't have to fight them here. Well, let me tell you what, folks, we are fighting them over here. And, of course, I started to write commentaries, and I made that point on some programs, and it didn't take too long before the politicians realized that that slogan wasn't working, so they abandoned it. They abandoned it. But the sheer fact that they would try to use that kind of deceptive argument should infuriate all of us. If our government is supposed to be a government by the people, for the people, that's not the way that a government represents the best interests of its people. It doesn't represent the best interests of its people when high-ranking officials within the immigration system can say that America can do well even if Americans aren't doing well, and to think otherwise is an antiquated perspective. Well, that's me, antiquated. I've been around long enough, and I know what this country meant to my parents, my mom who came here ahead of the Holocaust, my dad whose parents brought him here, or who actually his mom gave birth to him here, but they came here close to the turn of the previous century from Russia. America was that magical place. There isn't much magic any longer, and it's because of the lunacy that's coming out of Washington. When we are told that it is racist to want to enforce laws that are blind about race, but do seek to keep out those people who would hurt us, and then claim that somehow this is discriminatory, is crazy. As I said to Jeff, we all have front doors with doorbells and peepholes so that we can make a conscious decision as to who we should let in and who we should not let into our homes as a matter of personal safety and common sense. That's the sort of common sense that unfortunately is missing in Washington today. We can cause that to change, though. For the next 4 weeks, give or take, members of Congress are back in their home districts. They've left the swamp of Washington, and they are home. And what I'm going to ask all of you who are good enough to be listening to my program this evening, and I thank you for being here, is you must, within this next week, make phone calls to the district office of your elected representative in Congress and tell the people there that you want a meeting. And I would suggest you get together with your neighbors and you go meet with your congressman, you meet with his staff, and you make it clear that it makes no sense to import more foreign workers than the number of new jobs that are being created, that it makes no sense to provide in-state tuition for illegal aliens when American children, including kids with learning disabilities, are finding those very important programs being defunded to deal with autism and other such issues. It is not anti-immigrant to be pro-American. Americans come in every flavor, every color of the rainbow. Ask yourself, what does the average American look like? And there is no such thing as an average American. Americans are black and white, green and purple, polka dot and striped. We come in every religion, every ethnicity. This isn't about racism. This is about a government that is trying to deliver to Alan Greenspan yet again his vision of engineering America so that the folks at the very top of the food chain, believe it or not, we'll have even more wealth and more power. Unbelievable. This isn't a conservative issue. It's not a liberal issue. It's an American issue. A young lady by the name of Barbara Jordan, she's passed away, but she was a member of Congress, and she was a very liberal Democrat. A black woman was dead set against illegal immigration. She wrote a report known as the Jordan Commission, where she took a position that basically parallels what we've been discussing this evening. What is lacking in the equation, folks, is participation by the citizens of this country. The founding fathers understood that the most important people in this democratic republic, not the president, not the secretary of state, what difference does that make, as she might have said when she was secretary, it's the citizens of the United States. The citizens of the United States are supposed to have the loudest voice. And indeed, there are 300 million of us, only 545 individuals sitting in both houses of Congress. Please make your voice heard. And if you think you're just one person, we survived Hurricane Sandy, and I can assure you that that horrific storm started with the first raindrop. We the people can turn things around, but as I always like to remind people, democracy is not a spectator sport. We definitely need to be involved. We definitely need to have our politicians made accountable to us, not the other way around. They are our employees, and when you look at how our employees have been running roughshod over us, something is terribly wrong, and only we the people can set it straight. I want to thank you for joining me this Friday evening. I hope you all have a wonderful weekend coming up, among the few remaining summer weekends. I hate to say it, but it's true. But I hope that you will find it to be a pleasurable weekend, whatever you do. But no matter what you do, please make a part of your weekend or set aside a part of your weekend to write letters to Congress and make arrangements to see your congressman or congresswoman and get your voice heard. I'm counting on you to pitch in and get the job done. We've only got a couple of weeks before they're at it again, and we've got to stop them in their tracks. We need to put the fear of the electorate back into our elected representatives. Again, folks, please go to my two favorite websites, michaelcutler.net, capsweb.org. Check out the commentaries, and I'll see you again next week at the same time. Have a great weekend, everybody. Good night for now.